Carl Sanders, former governor of Georgia, April 24th, 1974.
How do you see politics in Georgia right now? How do you assess the state of politics in Georgia?
In somewhat of a confused state right now. I don't think at the present time that there's any particular group or individual that you can look to as the leader of the people in this state. We don't have what we used to have. We used to have, back before the two-party system became a real thing, we sort of had individuals. Everybody was a Democrat, but we had personalities, and people would have this group and that group and the other group. It's pretty well splintered up in Georgia right now, and there is no one factor or one faction that you can consider as being the faction that is going to determine the results of any state election that I know of.
Do you see the Democrats in firm control of Georgia's political destinies for the foreseeable future?
Well, I think right now the Democrats are probably by far in better shape than they were in recent years, purely not because of what the Democrats have done, but because of what the Republicans have done. Republicans have lost what momentum they had going for them in this state. And they didn't have a great deal, but they were coming on and getting stronger and building up momentum, I'd say, for the last several years. And then all of this Watergate and all of this Nixon business and all that has just sort of taken all the wind out of those sails. And I don't think that they're going to mount any kind of substantial campaign, at least not for the governor's race. And I doubt if they will put too many strong candidates in any of the other races this year.
Have they shown any real growth in this state since 1966?
Yeah, I think they've shown some growth. They made some progress. They elected a few people. They made a pretty strong race in 66 with Callaway, and then they subsequently seemed to get a better grassroots organization than they'd ever had before. And when you say a great deal of growth, I think if you percentage-wise, if you looked at where they started from, say maybe 64, 65, and 66, and how they had come on, I think you'd have to give them credit for making right creditable strides. But they seem to be going backwards now rather than forward. You don't hear, naturally, you don't hear much out of them. Even their chairman and so-called leaders have sort of crawled under a rock and they've shut up. They're saying nothing. Whatever they say, it's generally in defense of something somebody else has said, and they're not out on a positive program of trying to sell the Republican Party.
Well, my point is that even in 72, where you had Nixon and Agnew and the Republican presidential campaign at the top sweeping the state with 70% of the vote, and
they didn't do too well.
They didn't do particularly well then?
No, they didn't. They really didn't have too strong a candidates running in the governor's race that year. And they made some gains in some of the local elections. They picked up some seats in the House, they picked up some seats in the Senate, in the legislature. I think they made some progress. You can't start. I think that was one of the fallacies of the 66 campaign, was that they started with the idea that, Bo Callaway started with the idea that the way to build a Republican Party in the state was to start at the top, build down. And he, of course, got nominated by the organization to run as a Republican candidate, and then he very deliberately headed off anybody else running, say either for lieutenant governor or some other race, because he didn't want anybody else running as a Republican that would be competing with him on the top thing. He had some theory that he would be able to pick up I guess, a lot of independent and Democratic votes as well as Republican votes and win by it. And of course, he got a lot of votes. But when he failed, there wasn't anything under him to fall back on. They were just leaderless and without any reserves to, so they had to start all over again, and they started trying to pick up a seat or two in the House and Senate, and they began to build up credibility.
I believe it was during your administration as governor that the Republican Party really began to get organized in Georgia.
It gained credibility when Barry Goldwater ran for the presidency against Lyndon Johnson. And in 1964, when that election was held, I was about the only state Democratic official who was even attempting to try to hold the Democratic Party up to the people as the party that they should support. All of our other Democratic officials were hurrying and scurrying all around the state, and some of them to foreign countries to completely avoid any semblance of support for the national ticket. And of course, Goldwater carried, what, five southern states or something, Georgia being one of them, and that gave them some credibility.
What effect did that have on the Democratic Party?
Well, I think in retrospect now, although at that time it seemed to prove that the Democratic Party, like I said, was a personality situation rather than a party situation, I think in retrospect now it finally got some of our state officials off of the dime and got them back into the thinking that they were going to have to hang together, they were going to hang separately. And some of them, in recent elections, who heretofore completely abhorred the idea of even being seen with a national Democrat or speaking on the same platform or giving any kind of illusion that they were part of the whole Democratic machinery, have now reversed themselves and they've become right actively involved. In fact, Herman Talmadge in recent years has gone about actively supporting some people for other offices which he wouldn't have done before. Of course, Dick Russell is no longer with us, but Dick Russell never did. Dick Russell absolutely refused to have anything to do with any other state Democratic election.
What other major changes did you see in the Democratic Party, say in the period we're looking at, 48 through 74?
Well, of course, the Democratic Party, as I say, in Georgia now, is greatly changed because of the reapportionment that took place in those years. We went through all the reapportionment of the legislature, and we changed the flavor of our General Assembly, or it's being changed gradually but constantly, from the rural to the more urban-oriented representatives and senators, and the flavor of the party changed. I took the first blacks to the first Democratic Convention, the National Democratic Convention in 1964, the first delegates that had ever been taken to this state. Took Leroy Johnson, who's still in the Senate, and heck was a guy's name who was head of the lawyer, Judge, I can't think of it now, but he was a black leader. I took them to Atlantic City as delegates, something that was sort of unheard of. Well, now today, of course, there's a greater variety of participation in the party, but there is less cohesiveness within the party. You don't have the strong representation by substantial people in communities that you used to have, but you have a different type of representation by different types of groups. You've got a lot of these, you might say, fringe groups that now are more actively participating, and this recent debacle in the last election, our present governor went through, accepted some of this George McGovern's recommendations of how to democratize the party, and the Democratic Party here at the last national convention here in Georgia was represented on the most part not by Democrats but by a lot of people who were really out into the fringe areas of the political spectrum who said they were Democrats in order to have a forum at which to speak on and speak out on. And when it comes down to really working in the Democratic Party for the candidates in the state elections and all, you don't find them very actively involved. But they went all out. There's a lot of students organized and had great success in winning delegate seats to the National Democratic Convention that had never before even been involved in the process. Now, that's not to say that that's not good, because that's what you want. I'd say today most of some of those people, or majority of those people who won in that method, have had nothing else to do with the Democratic Party since that time. They were just a flash in the pan.
The composition of the party has changed. What about the issues that you've talked about in the last 25 years? What's changed to it?
Well, that's a good question. When you say issues, when I ran for governor the first time, issues generally, or issues basically in the South in the early 60s, I guess, it was apparent to most people in this part of the country that moderation was a desirable issue on almost any political question. And the moderate, the Terry Sanford, the Carl Sanders, people of that stripe who were described as moderates, were looked upon as something that was the representative of the broad thinking of the electorate. The middle of the road was a wide place in the road. Today, maybe in 1974, that is beginning to again reappear. But I'd say from 66 to 72, middle of the road became the narrow spectrum of the road, and the shoulders, the left and right shoulder, became the broad places. And that's where you found people, and I think the South generally, swinging away from the idea of following a moderate middle of the road course or leadership. But they were either going violently to the left or to the right. And of course, in recent years, we've had more people in the South that have been postured over on the right shoulder than they have been on the left shoulder, although we've had some vocal people over on the left shoulder. And I think the conservatism reappeared, and it may still be just as strong in 74 as it was maybe, say, in 72. When Nixon took about, 80-something percent of the vote in this state, I get the feeling, though, that people are now beginning to moderate again and beginning to look to somebody who would represent a coalition of the thinking of the extremes and not just represent the extremes totally as the successful leader at this point.
Is race still the key, or one of the keys, to winning a statewide election?
I don't know. I think race is still involved. Is it a different level? It's definitely involved. It's involved for the simple reason that there are more black people registered in the southern states and in Georgia than ever before right now. They've never really, although they've registered and have been registered in the past, you go back and examine the actual elections, they have in most instances never really voted as well as they've registered. The percentage of votes cast in the election is not anywhere close to what the registration figures are quote-unquote supposed to be. That's a threat, and that's a potential election weight is hanging out there. I heard just a comment, I think, the other day from Andrew Young, who was back home speaking on the fact that Wallace in 76 couldn't carry the South because there were 465,000, I believe that's the figure used, blacks registered in Georgia, and I guess something similar to that maybe in other states, and under no circumstances would they vote for him, and he felt like that the candidate who espoused the conservative cause like Wallace just couldn't make it. I don't agree with that right now. I don't know whether that that may be a very real factor, but I think that race is still definitely in the picture of any election just because of the numerical number of people. But I don't think the idea of standing out in a on a political platform and saying that the issue of just race per se, that I'm for segregation and for whites versus blacks, that's no longer the factor that it was. I mean, we got the wildest kind of people that still running on this fellow, J.B. Stoner up here, who's an out-and-out racist, ran last time, he got 12,000 votes or 17,000 votes in the state.
So those days are gone, okay?
I don't know where they're gone. I couldn't say they're gone. I hope they are, I hope that we are, we have matured to the point where they will not ever reappear with the force and the divisiveness that they appeared previously, but I think there's still an underlying feeling and current that is there and that reappears in shapes and forms today that you just can't ignore. I think as long as we continue to have, for instance, in the Atlanta area, we continue to have the problems of crime, as long as those statistics still seem to relate themselves to the races, you still got a lot of people that say that I'm totally without prejudice, I'm absolutely objective, but when they go in that voting booth and cast a ballot, they still vote to some degree on whether a candidate is black or white.
Is it hard to think back to the days of 1963 and 64? Remember the how hot the race issue was then?
Oh, it's not hard for me to think back and remember.
Hard to conceive of the attitude change or the apparent attitude change since then?
In a lot of respects, yes, because those were rugged and violent days, and those were days, of course, when we were confronted every day with whether they were going to integrate the university or they were going to have people riding on the buses and sitting in the lunch counters. And just when you think back on them, it's hard to, it's amazing, I might add, in that short period of time to realize how so many of those sharp, violent points have been dulled. Flattened out. The race thing still, as I say, is still there, but it's whatever's being done now, it's done in a subtle fashion, and it's done obliquely rather than head on.
To what do you attribute that change, that dulling or that?
Well, I think the laws of the land, I think they finally, people have just come to the absolute conclusion that they can't no matter what local politicians stand up and profess and say that they can do to turn back the clock and to eliminate integrated facilities and schools and other things, that people know that that's just baloney, and that it's no longer an issue that's believable. I think the media, television, the press and everything else have exposed the citizens of this part of the country to the rest of the world and the rest of the country to an extent that where a thing used to be so absolutely abnormal that it's now many matters that involved housing and working conditions and individuals relating to each other that they are looked upon today as commonplace, where before they were just totally unheard of. And this is all, in a relative sense, is sort of people gotten used to it. So they don't have that quite, they don't have that urgency that they had before about this is something that's going to absolutely destroy us.
There was a theory, I think Senator Goldwater was one of the proponents of it, that changing laws would not change the hearts and minds of men. When you had the Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, the laws did change, practices changed. Do you think that people's attitudes did change as a result?
Some of the attitudes changed. I think, yes, I think people's attitudes have changed. However, I think that one of the reasons they've changed, too, is because there's been, since that time, you might say another generation that has reached maturity, and their attitudes are completely different from some of their fathers and their mothers. And some of the strongest people, most radical people, you say, on the other, either side of it, have passed on. They're no longer on the scene. They're no longer in positions of leadership or importance, and they don't. You don't have those people to constantly either inflame or to otherwise create confusion or create problems that they were very capable of, very easily able to do, say 10, 15 years ago.
What do you think was the reaction of most white Georgians to the assassination of Martin Luther King?
At the time that he was assassinated?
At the time and subsequently.
I think at the time he was assassinated, there wasn't any great reaction about white citizens. I think generally most white citizens didn't have any great sympathy with Martin Luther King in Georgia at the time of his assassination. I think probably since that time, due to the constant effort and I guess program to educate and enlighten people on what his nonviolent philosophy probably represented as compared to people like Black Panthers now or the Symbionese Liberation Armies and things of that kind, that people have probably in retrospect said, well, you know, maybe this fellow, we should have given him credit for, given him more credit for what he was doing than we gave him at the time. So I think in retrospect now they probably feel that he was a more effective leader for the cause that he represented than they respected him for at the time that he was doing the job.
Do you think reapportionment has had a genuinely significant effect on Georgia more than almost any other state?
I don't know about any other state. I think it's had an effect on Georgia. I don't know what.
How about in terms of state government? What is reapportionment meant?
Well, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending upon how you look at it, I would say, in my point of view, it might be more unfortunate than fortunate. It's pretty well, in recent years, has meant the difference between having a strong executive type of government in this state as compared to what I would now call a weak executive type government, due to the reapportionment to senators now. You know, back in 15 years ago, the Georgia Senate rotated. Actually, they didn't have any real continuity. The senator would serve one term or so, and then he would rotate to another county, another group, and you'd have probably 50% of the senators each year would be brand new, or each election would be brand new faces coming in. And so they really didn't have any continuity of leadership. I was fortunate when I was in the Senate, I was able to get other counties to waive the right to elect the senator, and I stayed in for three terms, which was unheard of. Today, of course, they don't have that. Today, they've got the more urban flavor in the House and all. They have declared themselves to be independent of the legislative branch of government. They now take great delight in challenging the governor's authority as, say, the budget director to present an executive budget and all. And it's just sort of a three-ring circus compared to what it used to be.
What would you rank as the most significant achievement of the administration?
My rank of the most significant achievement of my administration? Probably the total overhaul of all of the educational facilities of this state, higher education and the elementary and secondary. We completely rewrote all the educational laws. I funded it. I built junior colleges, and I put more brick and mortar in the university system of Georgia in 4 years and all of its previous history. I raised the teacher's salaries. I brought in people from educators from all over the country that heretofore wouldn't have set foot in the state. And I think that probably would have been the number one achievement, although I could go on like anybody and give you many, many achievements that I'm proud of. But I think that probably was the most lasting achievement. I don't think we've had an educational program of anything close to the size or scope that I had since I left office.
What would you have done if you'd been elected in 1970?
Oh, I would have done many things. I had all sorts of ideas and things, but it's, I should say, what would I have done? I was not elected, so I didn't do it. But at that point, I had, I was so full of ideas and things that I wanted to do and things that I'd left undone that I had started, I wanted to continue, that I would have, I think I'd have done, I believe I could have done as much if not more than I had done previously, but I didn't get a chance to do that, so I turned my activities and my energy and my thoughts to my individual opportunities, and I have enjoyed that immensely.
Gonna run again?
No, don't have any plans to, simply because I think the arena at this point and the rules by which you now have to offer are such that make it most unattractive for not only me, but anybody that has spent any time in his life trying to achieve some success. I think you almost have to totally, completely give up and disassociate yourself sacrifice everything that you are related to in any shape, form, or fashion in order to go back in as an acceptable type candidate today. And I just don't think that at this point in my life, with the things that I'm doing, that I would want to do that, but I would prefer to help other people who I believe represent the same thinking that I have and who can do a good job. I'd rather help them achieve the opportunity to serve in those offices.
How do you see yourself now, philosophically? You were one of the first of the first crop of New South governors. Now we've got a second crop of New South governors. How do you see yourself in relationship to them?
Well, I think that the first crop has been better than the second crop, let's put it that way. I think we were at the crossroads. We were in the line of fire to a much greater extent than the second crop. And And I think that we were able to turn the tide and move the thinking and move the direction of our states. In my case, and in the case of most of these southern governors, toward a more enlightening and a more progressive future than what has subsequently happened. I don't think the subsequent crop, and I'm just speaking of crop in a general sense, have taken advantage of the foundations that were laid and the tremendous change in direction that was accomplished, and have built upon that or embroidered upon it as greatly or as much as they could have, should have.
How important do you consider constitutional reform in Georgia?
I think constitutional reform in Georgia is badly needed. I rewrote the Constitution in 1964, got it through the General Assembly, got it approved, and then had the federal court here deny us. We had to rewrote all the election laws in the Constitution in a special session. It's the toughest, hardest job that I have ever encountered legislatively. And then had the federal court here approve the election code as being valid, but disapprove the submission of the Constitution to the people on the ground that it was written by a malapportioned General Assembly at the time. We appealed it, sent it up to the Supreme Court. They would not accelerate our hearing, and so they subsequently agreed with our position. It should have been placed on the ballot, but it was too late to put it on the ballot. So we didn't get it. And since that time, there's been a lot of conversation and nothing else done about it. Every year over there, they talk about rewriting the Constitution and revamping it. Right now in Georgia, it's been amended so many times, there's no place that I know of anywhere in Georgia you could go and see the Constitution of Georgia in one document. Nobody really knows what it looks like. It's been amended thousands of times.
Who are the major changes that you'd written in?
What
were the major changes in the document you worked on?
Basically, the major changes were we simplified it and went back to something more akin to what you might call the model type constitution, state constitution that the organization of state council governments and all had recommended and all, and we provided home rule and all other things, which they have in forms and fashions now, but which nobody really, everybody's got a different little variety of it. We would have made it a modern 20th century constitution as compared to an 18th century or 19th century constitution.
Is that when you ran for governor, that originally you had filed for lieutenant governor,
right.
Then the decision came down ending the county unit system?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, I had already, when the decision came down ending the county unit system, I was already in the governor. The decision didn't come down until the early part of the summer. I qualified for governor. A month or so in advance of that. The decision came out after I had already officially qualified as governor.
The suit itself had been filed.
The suit had been filed for several months, but there was no decision, no way for me, anybody else to know when the hell it was. My decision to run for governor didn't have a thing in the world to do with that county.
What was it, big time?
Based on primarily that I made up my mind as I went around the state, first of all, the two candidates who were running for governor were Griffin and Garland-Byrd, who was lieutenant governor. As I went around the state, I realized as I was speaking all over the state that people were not satisfied with either one of them. People everywhere I went kept imploring me and begging me to get in the governor's race.
Well, of course, I was president pro tem of the Senate, and I knew what the lieutenant governor's job entailed, and I finally made up my own mind that if I didn't go ahead and get into the governor's race, that I'd spend 4 years in a lieutenant governor's office just running errands, so to speak, because it was not a job and a great deal of authority. And I had a real pressing problem with my law practice. It had grown to the point where I was having to work around the clock to keep up my practice and also attend my political affairs. So it just, everything came together, and it just made it almost imperative that I go for the governorship. So I went for it. Just win, lose, or draw. I just made up my mind.
As it turned out, am I correct, you would have been elected
out of
the county unit system?
County unit system, popular vote-wise, any way you can count the votes, I won.
And I presume that you had that feeling based on having gone around, you'd win either way.
Yeah, that's right. If I had been depending just upon some county unit thing or something, I wouldn't have made the race, but I felt like I'd win it anyway. The election went, and when the votes were counted, if they excluded all the black votes, I still won it over with all. I had a majority of the white votes. I had a majority of the black votes. I had a majority of the county unit votes. I had a majority of the poppy votes.
Were you polling at the time?
Yes. We polled. We had a poll done by Lou Harris. Of course, when I started out, I was had the same problem that many never made a state race head, and that was a recognition factor. I had a positive profile. Griffin had a negative profile, but he had a hell of a advantage over me in the recognition factor. I took the positive profile that I had. Those people who knew me positively and knew me in that fashion. Of course, I was able to develop from that foundation the recognition all over the state and profile, and that's why I won.
You know, based on the campaign itself and the poll, which tells you what the voters are thinking to some extent, what they're responding to, what was the central focus in the campaign on? How do you rate the determining factors in that election?
Well, that election determined to a great extent on the issue of corruption in government. Griffin's administration, as you may or may not know, has been
been
pretty high, wide, and handsome. They had some folks indicted and all that kind of thing. So it was a good one of the issues, of course, honestly. Of course, I was sort of a knight on a white horse, a young moderate riding.
What was Byrd's problem in that way?
Byrd was too much of a me too-ism as far as Griffin. He sounded like and talked like and everything Griffin could say vice versa was me too. Just wasn't any difference between them. They were just both running down the same track and the same rut.
Okay, Griffin, you were running on a platform of what?
Well, I was running on a platform of, in effect, let's get Georgia moving again. It's a new day. Let's put in a fresh new leader, moderate leader who can keep the extreme forces at bay and make progress, and let's have a good administration.
Now that was in 62, right?
That was in 62.
Okay, that was the year in South Carolina you had Donald Russell running as a moderate, winning overwhelmingly. Also the year that you had George Wallace running, I guess you could say, as an immoderate and winning.
I don't think George Wallace, I think, ran the year before. Because Wallace came over in 62 when I ran and sat on the platform with Marvin Griffin and give him some kind of moral support in America's Georgia. So Wallace was already elected. He'd been elected, I think, in 61 for some reason. I believe that's right.
He was elected in 62, but he wasn't done with
it. Maybe he was, and he was...
Their primary may have been over.
Maybe that's what it was, but he sure...
When was the primary here?
Primary was in September.
Yeah, I think it was kind of back in probably in June, so that was probably the election before here, but...
Yeah. He was already the governor or governor-elect. All right.
All right, now what accounts for the election of you as a moderate? See, when you were running at the moderate, is that right?
Right.
You as a moderate in 62, and then the election of Maddox in 66.
Well, Maddox wasn't elected. Maddox was elected by the legislature.
Well, I understand that, but he won the Democratic primary.
Well, he won the Democratic primary in 1966. Purely because Ellis Arnold was primary. Ellis Arnold was has always been known as an extreme liberal. Maddox was able to put together some moderate and some conservative forces that gave him the vote that he got.
Was the Republican crossover vote decisive in that election?
What decided in Maddox's case,
right.
I think it had something to do with it because there was no question about it. The Republicans had put the word out, Callaway and all the rest of them officially had put the word out, vote for Maddox because he's the guy we beat.
Okay, there's one thing I really wish you'd clarify, and I'd like for you to really be candid if you would, and if you want to go up and say for not bad tribution, that'll be fine. But I really want to understand that has to do with the election of Maddox. And I recall you had a complicated legal situation.
Yeah, I don't want it for attribution purposes, but
fine.
We supported Maddox. I supported Maddox because Callaway, the first speech Bo Callaway made when he ran for governor was a speech in which he criticized me personally for accumulating $140 million in surplus, which I left in the Treasury when I walked out of office. He said that was irresponsible administration or government. That was fiscally irresponsible. Of course, that was the craziest thing in the world because no government in the history of the state had ever left the kind of money that I had left, and no government had ever spent the money that I'd spent and done the things that I'd done without a tax increase. But I just had that surplus money, and I knew they needed it, and I knew that I'd rather pour it down a rat hole. I was going to treat the state's money like I treat my own. Well, that was the first indication to me that Callaway, number one, didn't know what he was doing, and number two, he was irresponsible in jumping at conclusions. Then later on, Callaway came to see me right after that and apologized that he made a hell of a mistake. And I said, well, don't worry about that. That's the game. But later on, through friends of mine who were friends of his, it became obvious to me that Callaway was just absolutely so damn bullheaded about everything that he wanted to do. He wouldn't listen to anybody. And he totally, completely just went down a road to oblivion. Well, now, Maddox, of course, was no factor at that time. He was a guy who'd been running around here shouting and talking about being elected to something, and all of a sudden, there he was. It was a question of whether we were a Democratic legislature was going to have a chance to elect a Democratic governor, or whether they were going to elect a Republican. Now, in the meantime, the Constitution, of course, at that point, had no provision for a runoff. The Constitution of Georgia, which had been in being for hundreds of years, simply provided that in the event nobody received a majority of the votes in the general election, that it would then be up to the members of the legislature to elect, just like the Electoral College, in effect. So Callaway filed a lawsuit to force a runoff, I mean a special election, between him and Maddox. The Supreme Court of Georgia in the interim time came down with a decision upholding the Constitution of Georgia. Now, there wasn't any funny business about any of it. I mean, it was just strictly, of course, some of Callaway's friends. When the case was filed with the Supreme Court of Georgia, wanted me as the governor to try to take the position with the Attorney General of Georgia to, in effect, tell them that, you know, they shouldn't uphold the law, but this case ought to just be, everybody ought to just determine it on the basis of what they think ought to be done, not on what the law ought to be. And the Attorney General of Georgia ought to take the position there ought to be a special election. And I told them in very candid terms that I wasn't going to be a party to that. Whatever the law was, the Attorney General of Georgia was elected to uphold it. Whatever it was, he was going to abide by it. I was going to abide by it. We'd all abide by it.
Let me tell you a story we heard. I'm trying to find out if it's true.
Okay.
Well, a couple of versions. But one is that there was some element in the legislature who felt that because of Maddox's position at that time, public image at that time, that we can't afford to have less of Maddox's government. This simply included the Democrats who approached Callaway, talked to him, and the more they talked to him, they just realized he didn't know what such strength he had in the legislature, and they became less and less impressed. In addition to that, you had another element in the legislature who just felt, and in the state, that were politically active people, who felt that Lester Maddox just considered him to be somebody who was not particularly bright, knew very little about government, and that if he became governor, he wouldn't have a whole hell of a lot to do with state policy that would probably be controlled by the legislature. But if you had Callaway, you'd probably be inaugurating a whole series of Republican governors.
Well, there may be a semblance of truth in both of those thoughts. Now, I don't know who the people were that were thinking that, but I think that, I think that there probably was some thought that if you inaugurated a Republican government, that might just turn itself into a continuation of the Republican government for a while. All Democrats that I know of weren't very much interested in that. The other thing was that, yes, there was some thought and some realization among people in the legislature that Lester Maddox was a very unsophisticated politician when it came to running